Welcome to the Generations Radio Broadcast. Kevin Swanson, your host, with you today. I'm a father of five. We're raising our children out in Eastern Plains of Colorado. During the demise of Western civilization, the breakdown of Western Christian culture, and as it turns out, most of the world does not share our worldview. That shouldn't be a surprise or a shock to any of you who have listened to my program for more than 5 minutes. The worldview that is maintained by Hollywood and by the mass culture is not the worldview reflected on this radio program. That's a heads up for some of you new to the program. So from time to time, we look at what Hollywood is doing, especially with the major blockbusters. We really want to know what's happening because as it turns out, probably close to 95% to 98% of Christians out there are watching movies, and we understand that there are probably 2% to 3% of the population, maybe 5% to 8% of those who listen to this radio program that do not watch movies. But for the rest of those Christians who are still sort of connected to the pop culture, to the major cultural emanations coming out of Hollywood and Nashville, we'd like to, from time to time, get back to what they're doing and analyze it from a distinctively Christian perspective or a biblical worldview. And so, you know, you got to ask yourself the question from time to time, does Hollywood share our worldview? Does Hollywood, do you think the average director at Hollywood has attended Summit Ministries and Worldview Academy with Bill Jack? I don't think so. My daughter Emily is right here in studio with me because we just went to see a movie. Em, what do you think? Do you think that the director of the movie we saw tonight attended Bill Jack's Worldview Academy?
I'm thinking probably not.
Doubtful. Okay. The fact of the matter is, friends, I mean, somebody needs to step out and say, I don't think they share our worldview. Now, what's interesting is that we watch these movies, we get sucked into the cultural concepts or the cultural emanations of these false worldviews, and we accept the culture while we, at the same time, say, well, we don't agree with their worldview, but we like everything they do, all their movies they produce. And that doesn't make any sense at all. It seems to me that Christians ought to screw their brains on straight and analyze the movies that are being produced and the movies that are effectively educating the masses and setting the worldview perspective of the masses, of the 94-98% of the people who watch movies. Well, as it turns out, friends, Hunger Games: Catching Fire set a box office record at $161 million for a single weekend. That's a November box office record. And it comes after, of course, the first Hunger Games movie produced, I think, about this time in 2012. Might have been a little further back.
It was March 2012.
March 2012. Thanks, Sam. And so there's been a lot of Christians, of course, running out to see this. Everybody's sort of excited, and they want to participate in the mass culture and see what the mass culture is producing. And these movies are pretty entertaining. They've been put together with hundreds of millions of dollars of funding, and they've done a good job with the special effects. So, of course, people want to see these movies, and so many Christians are all gaga about this. Well, first of all, Emily and Rebecca, my two daughters, were with me tonight as we reviewed the movie, and we marched into the theater with our notebooks, the pens in hands, and we took notes. Well, first of all, girls, it's different when you sit there taking notes, isn't it?
Yeah, it's definitely different. It kind of, when you take your eye off the big screen and you get your eye on your notebook, it kind of breaks that whole trance that you
have. It does. It breaks the spell.
Uh-huh. It does.
Yeah. And so suddenly you're actually thinking critically about what's
going on.
Yeah,
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, that's a good thing. It's easy just to get into the trance of it, but it's important for us as Christians to analyze what's happening. I mean, you don't want these worldviews, these zeitgeists or spirits of the age to be manipulating your mind, especially when we're supposed to be renewing our minds by the Word of God.
Yeah, and I think the filmmakers, they went into the film production thinking, okay, we have our worldview and we're going to wrap this all into the story. And they were very engaged with their minds in the process, so why shouldn't we be engaged with our minds in the process watching the
mm-hmm.
film?
Mm-hmm. Now, I think a lot of Christians and conservatives kind of like this film because there's an opposition to tyranny here. And tyranny is something that I'm not all that excited about either. And you girls know that, right? I can get a little passionate against tyranny. I've done that on the radio show, and I do it in front of the family sometimes, just around the dinner table, right? If there's tyranny around, it bothers me. I don't like tyranny. It's interesting, though, that, you know, apparently this movie is very exciting. People get all wrapped up in this and hope that somehow this girl leads a major revolution against this tyrannical communist government. And yet, when I get on the microphones on this radio program and I get excited and wave my arms around and try to get, you know, 20 people interested in fighting the tyranny in Washington, D.C. and opposing Obamacare or the rising socialist trends of the day, I don't get as much support as Katniss does. And that bothers me.
People are like, tyranny? What tyranny?
Exactly. They're asleep. They're just accepting it, aren't they? So that bothers me. Now, the way in which this worldview looks at tyranny, defines tyranny, and establishes an approach to addressing tyranny is different than what the scriptures give to us. I think people ought to oppose tyranny. I think they ought to cry out against the tyrants, as Samuel puts it in 1 Samuel chapter 8, when a government takes more than a tenth of the people's income. Samuel says that people cry out to God against this tyrants, and it's appropriate to cry out. It's appropriate to register a complaint. But at the same time, the way in which you do it is not by revolution. The Bible doesn't allow for revolution. So in introduction here, I'm going to go back to what we said over the first movie a year and a half ago, and then we're going to address this one and look at some of the differences. Okay, so briefly, let me hit some of the things we said the first time around. You can't just run out there and shoot the president or shoot the governor whenever you want to. Now, I know it's a shock to some of the people, some of the conservatives, you know, the gun-toting Western conservative Christian people out there. I'm sorry, you can't do that. Now, as it turns out, biblically speaking, you can align yourself with another magistrate or a lower magistrate, as in a sheriff, and or a state government, and oppose a tyranny that might be trying to impose something on you from, say, across the ocean in England or somewhere else. You can align yourself with a government that might be able to fight another tyrant that's trying to tyrannize the people. So that kind of thing can happen. But you just can't run out there and shoot the president anytime you want. And we typically use the example of David and Saul. In fact, we're studying David and Saul right now for Samuel. We've been reading chapters 20 to 25 this week, ironically. And David was tyrannized by Saul.
Very much so, yes. By Saul.
It was rough. It was rough. He was hunting him down. He was just a tyrant. Saul is probably the worst tyrant of the Old Testament, one of the very worst of the Old Testament, right? And yet David did not, even when he had the opportunity in that cave, remember? He did not touch the Lord's anointing. Now, he cut off a little piece of his garment, and then he felt guilty about that. But he would not touch the Lord's anointing. Now, what they've done in this movie is they have established an ethical conundrum that's supposed to be worked out by 13-year-old girls and 15-year-old boys who watch the movie. But I don't think that's really the way it works. Typically, 13-year-old girls don't understand ethical conundrums, so they get all wrapped up in this thing, and they wind up supporting the heroine in the movie. And that's problematic for me because it sets up our youth with the idea that anytime you have an ethical conundrum, we move into the area of ethical relativism, and we can break God's law on pragmatic reasons, and kids can kill kids. And that's, I think, something we need to keep in front of us as we talk about the Hunger Games. These are kids killing kids. It ought to be a little bothersome to some out there that kids are killing kids, and kids are learning about how wonderful it is to kill kids. And that, to me, ought to be a little bothersome to parents who are letting their kids watch these movies. Now, here's the conundrum. If the civil magistrate forces you to kill another innocent person, should you submit to that? On the other hand, if the civil magistrate sends deputies to your home to kill you, should you resist and shoot the deputies? See, those are two issues that are being imposed upon this little girl in this gladiator game called the Hunger Games. That's the ethical conundrum. Now, last time we talked about the other approach, and that was the Christian monk who who bought a ticket to get across the Mediterranean Sea, showed up at the Colosseum in Rome, jumped into the middle of the whole thing, and started screaming, "Stop the madness! Stop the madness! Stop the madness!" until he was slaughtered. And that was pretty much the end of the Roman games.
Because everyone was really sobered. They actually saw what they were doing, what they were desensitized to.
Because
it was the shedding of innocent blood.
Somebody was willing to just stand up and say, "Stop the killing, stop the killing," and would not participate in it. Now, okay, if the civil magistrate forces you to kill another innocent citizen, here's the question. Should you submit? Now, the biblical text is the Hebrew midwives. Hebrew midwives were encouraged and forced by the Pharaoh to kill innocent citizens. They refused to do so and were commended by God for their refusal. Okay, so that's the answer to the first ethical question. The second ethical question is, the civil magistrate sends deputies to your home to kill you, should you resist and shoot the deputies? In other words, some of these other players in this field have been deputized or challenged to kill you by the civil magistrate in this dystopia. And the answer is David would not lay a hand on the Lord's anointed. Now, here's the fundamental problem. The average humanist or the naturalist that watches this movie or plays a part in this story do not believe in God. So they don't believe that God appointed the civil magistrate as a minister of God. You see, Romans 13 isn't even a consideration by the director or by the writer, Suzanne Collins. Not even consideration. Why? Because God's not a consideration.
You see, he's only a consideration in your swear words.
That's right. That's right. So in terms of the metaphysic, okay, the very, very basic metaphysic, and that's the most fundamental issue. And there's lots of issues to discuss on this movie. There's some good things and some bad things. But the fundamental building blocks of the story, the foundation of the story, is the metaphysic, the theory of reality. And in this theory of reality, we know that men consider themselves to be real, but they don't consider God to be real. And that's the problem. They do not consider God to be real. And, boy, they took God's name in vain a bunch of times. I lost count. I was trying to do the hash thing in the dark. I think I was up to 7 or 8, and Katniss was doing the honors, most of it. Mm-hmm.
It was mostly the women, actually, who were doing a lot of the cursing.
Yeah, the women did most of the cursing, yeah. And she, when they cursed, they would just, you know, God, they would just, blah, just, you know, and suddenly you think, oh, wow, they're bringing God into the metaphysic, you know, whoa, this is wonderful, they're praying to God, but they're not. They're actually just being good Christian apostates who are, you know, taking the opportunity to give God an obscene gesture. I mean, they're taking the opportunity to say, you know, hey, I could care less about the true and living God right now to the extent that I really want to take his name in vain. So not only is God not a factor, but God is being mocked in the language of the heroine.
And you notice, too, like they're not going, oh, my Buddha or anything like that.
No.
They're taking God's name in vain because they hate God.
It's the Christian God they're going after. Right. And it's interesting, you know, if there's supposed to be a bunch of naturalists or materialists who don't believe that God exists, I'm not sure why they keep mentioning his name, except for the fact that they hate his guts, you know, or they just want to dishonor him as often as they possibly can. And that's really what's happened to our society. It's just a reflection of our society. So I think the average person watching could care less about what we're saying right now.
Because that's the world that we live in.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Now, let's look at the differences between the first and the second. Emily, you were there with the first movie when we reviewed it a year and a half ago. Do you think there's much of a difference? Is Katniss repenting of her desire to kill? Seems like there's some tension in her.
There's definitely, I could picture a lot of wrestling in her because she'd wake up with dreams and she'd wake up with nightmares of her killing people, and it was really bothering her. But then when it came down to the wire and she actually had to, quote-unquote, kill people, she did.
As it turns out, she killed Gloss.
Right.
Okay.
She had no reservation.
She killed Gloss.
About it.
Yeah. So I looked that up, because it looked to me like she killed somebody. Maybe 2 or 3. I wasn't sure. But for sure, she killed Gloss.
Yes, she did.
Okay. And she certainly intended to kill others, it seems to me. Do you remember when they wanted to electrocute people? She was right on board. She was, yeah, let's do it. This is exciting. Let's get on with it.
She didn't say, oh, but that'll kill other people.
Yeah. That would be murder. That would be a violation of the Sixth Commandment.
Yeah.
I didn't hear her bring up the Sixth Commandment, did you?
Basically, you just save whoever you care about, and then the other people are disposable to them because there's really no value in human life.
Mm-hmm. Rebecca, what does God say about murder?
God doesn't like it.
Don't do it.
No, he doesn't like it.
Yeah.
He values human life.
But did you notice she didn't bring up God or his law?
No, that didn't occur in this film.
Why would it be wrong to kill at all? I mean, why would she even be wrestling with it?
Well, there should be no reservations at all, technically.
I guess not.
If there's no God, she should just kill whoever, whenever, whatever. It doesn't matter.
Yeah. Dostoevsky said, if God doesn't exist, all things are possible.
Yeah, and she shouldn't worry about her family either, because technically if God doesn't exist, that means that her family doesn't matter either.
Yeah.
And the government can kill them.
In the ultimate sense, yeah, it's true. Okay, let's get on with things here. There was a lot of kissing going on. I mean, there was more kissing than I think I've ever seen.
And this wasn't even a romance film.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't. I mean, this was more kissing than a romance film. This was, it was, I think, just out of control. And I was uncomfortable. Personally, I just got sick of watching it, to be honest with you. And, you know, it wasn't just a peck on the cheek either.
No, it was passionate kissing, for sure.
That's right. And I kept thinking of 1 Corinthians 7:1, where Paul said it's not good for a man to touch a woman. But he says, get married, and then you can touch. I mean, that's kind of 1 Corinthians 7, okay? But it begins with, I would that a man not touch a woman. And the word for touch there means kind of that real intimate, you know, touch, the sort of thing that was happening on the film.
Definitely what they were doing.
Exactly. So, you know, it's just, now here's the other thing that bothered me, is that she's kissing different guys. Equally, it's like equal opportunity kissing. I mean, it's, you know, same amount of passion, really. And I couldn't really tell what she liked. It seemed like she was going back and forth. I couldn't tell for sure, especially towards the end. It seemed like she really liked Peeta, but then she really liked the other guy, too, whatever his name was.
It felt like love didn't really mean anything because there was no depth.
Yeah.
There was just this kind of loosey-goosey, I can go and fornicate with whoever I want whenever my passion directs that I do so.
Mm-hmm.
But there was no appreciation for the sacredness of marriage.
Kind of an American dating thing. You know, she's just on a different date every other Friday. That's kind of the way it felt. And I didn't appreciate that very much at all. Okay. The undressing scene, we had to turn our eyes. Okay. And I think everybody needs to heads up. It was just, we knew it was coming. It was sort of announced, like, okay, this is going to happen. So we all turned our eyes. And they made fun out of it, and they thought it was humorous, they thought it was totally acceptable.
I thought that was really interesting, because as soon as that scene came, the people in the theater were laughing really hard, and that was the hardest anyone had ever laughed.
Yeah.
And I thought it was funny, because in the Capitol, these people make light of things that are really serious, and the people in the theater were doing the same thing that the people in the Capitol were doing. And the people in the Capitol are the people that everyone despises.
Mm-hmm.
But we're acting just like them.
Yeah. And when it came down to it, it seemed like they were pretty much cut out of the same cloth. They were acting the same way. They were doing shameful things and thinking that they weren't shameful. And that's to me kind of sad. It's an indication of what we've all become. And this is one thing that bothers me about these films. And it's why I think we as Christians need to back away from it. You know, we do have to turn our heads, certainly from certain scenes. And we don't want to be pulled into the worldview expressed there. Now, we talked a little bit about the metaphysic, but let's talk about the bad guys. The bad guys were communists, and they seemed to want to get rid of the free market. But as it turns out, the solution to the problem was not found in the revolution. The fundamental social problem here was, as I said the first time, the lack of fathers. How many fathers did you see in the film?
Well, There was one grandfather.
There was one grandfather, yeah. And that was like a breath of fresh air. I was a grandfather. And his little granddaughter, who was probably the brightest part of the movie. But I think everybody needs to know that grandfather was the super bad guy.
Yeah, he was the evil one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you have a halfway decent social situation there for just 1 second, but it turns out to be the bad guy.
And then you have the teenagers and the moms kind of saying, "We're going to save civilization. Yeah. Don't worry about it. Yeah. We got it, guys.
We got the kids. We got it.
Stay there."
Yeah. The kids and the moms are going to take care of it. Reminding me of Isaiah 3:12. "As for my people, children are their oppressors, and women rule over them. O my people, they which lead thee cause thee to err and destroy the way of thy paths." The fundamental problem is the breakdown of society. See, that's the problem. It's not going to be fixed until the social problem is fixed. And the men, if you want to look at the men in the film, just think about the men. They were tyrants, right? A couple of men that were definitely the tyrants. They were wimpy, and they were led around by the nose by women. That's pretty much it, right? And PETA is a puppy dog. I mean, he was cute, and he was nice, and he was fluffy. And he did everything that his mistress told him to do. He was a puppy dog.
He kind of followed Katniss's whims.
Yeah. Yeah, he did.
Because Katniss was pretty much the leader of the group.
And
revolution.
And girls, if society is so broken down, there are no fathers left. Probably no sheriffs with courage and guts to defend the people from tyrants. Boy, what do you get? What do you get when you don't have any men? I guess you get Katniss. And Katniss is going to save society. And that's, I guess, what's supposed to happen in the third sequel to this. But I don't think it happens that well. It says nobody lives happily ever after in this story. And that's probably what makes this so depressing. It's by far the most popular movie available right now. It's also interesting, girls, that the most popular movie that people watch are movies about witches, about vampires, and about little girl anarchists or revolutionaries. You know, these are the movies that are drawing people in, and they're really effectively dystopian movies that present a very negative picture of things. Now, there's an internal contradiction here, too, that I wanted to bring out. The Empire appeared to be designed by Lady Gaga. Now, no surprise there, because as it turns out, the director of the movie directs Lady Gaga's music videos. So I wasn't surprised at all when I figured that out. Okay, I get it. In fact, I had written it down. The wardrobes, the Empire is designed by Lady Gaga. I wrote that down in my notes. And then I came home and I said, who's this director and what does he direct? Sure enough, he directs Lady Gaga music videos. Okay, so Lady Gaga was the one who designed the whole world around this dystopia in the Hunger Games. And girls, you understand that Lady Gaga is pretty well known for being what we would call a nihilist. She's a sexual nihilist or a cultural nihilist. In other words, she makes fun of herself. She's self-destructive, and she destroys her own art forms as she goes. She also is very well known for mocking anybody who appreciates her art form, because she sees that as another exhibition of a society that's destroying itself. So she laughs at the self-destruction of those that listen to her self-destructive form of art. So this is what we would call a postmodern nihilist. And what you get in this movie is a picture of this nihilism, this self-mockery. There's nobody's taking themselves seriously. You know, you have all the makeup and all the clothing that looks like a whole bunch of clowns. Effectively, they're just a bunch of clowns. There's like 1,000 clowns that show up to watch these Hunger Games. Nobody takes themselves seriously. They don't take the Hunger Games seriously. And if a society looks like Lady Gaga and her sexual nihilism, cultural nihilism, the society is not interested in surviving anyway. So this is an internal contradiction, a major internal contradiction that destroys the whole story.
Because the society would have just broken down anyways with or without the revolution. The revolution just served to break it down quicker.
Exactly. Now, let me present this scenario to you girls, because this is the scenario that people are grappling with. Let's say that the world slipped into a one-world dystopia like this, where there was no possibility of freedom. You couldn't escape the Soviet Union into America. You know, you couldn't get out of this communist, horrific dystopia. Now, first of all, I believe that there is a God. And I believe that there is a Christ who came to save the world, John 3:16. Okay, I believe that. So I don't believe that Suzanne Collins' Hunger Games scenario could ever really come about as they have brought it about. Okay, I think that God is so sovereign, and God is so good, and God is so able to protect his people, to protect his church, to provide for what I would call a second Mayflower. And I wrote a book called The Second Mayflower. That I don't think this kind of thing could happen. But let's say, for instance, that you are locked into a perpetual tyranny, anarchy nightmare like this, where it's just either tyranny or it's massive bloody revolutions where you're killing hundreds of thousands or hundreds of millions of people. Okay, so you move from a tyranny to a revolution, back to another tyranny, because typically if a society is so broken down that it's run by tyrants, the people are so lacking in self-government that they're not going to produce anybody that's going to be able to provide good leadership except one more dictator. So the same cesspool that created the first dictator that runs the world creates more dictators that just follow him in successive revolutions. And that's what a dystopia is. It's just this horrific world in which you move from one tyranny to another revolution, back to another tyranny, back to another revolution, and you're locked into this perpetual tyranny anarchy nightmare. Well, how in the world do you move out of this but by regeneration, not by revolution? Okay, so that's the Christian response to this, meaning that what we're looking for are preachers,
mm-hmm.
evangelists, pastors, yeah. who get their walking stick. They get their sandals on and they just move from town to town and they preach and they preach and they preach until people get saved.
Because it's the hearts of people that need to change.
That's right. That's right. What causes the evil is not the environment. It's not the government. It's the hearts of the people. And the people typically get the government they deserve. So if you want to fix the government, you've got to fix the people.
Right. Because the government is made out of individual people.
Yeah.
And it's those people that come from the whole nation
mm-hmm.
that will come and make up this government, and that's what they deserve because that's how they are.
Yeah, and hopefully after a period of time, as God works in the hearts of people, they become self-governing. They begin to govern themselves, govern their own families, and fathers begin to help to build godly character into their sons and daughters, and over time things improve, and out of that come very wise leaders who can carefully balance between the liberty of the individual and the structure of the corporate body, you know, tyranny versus anarchy. They can balance that out because they understand God's laws, and they begin to work God's law, not just through government, but through the fabric of individual lives and families and local churches and communities. And so as they begin to build the system of build on God's laws, they maximize liberty, and their leaders know how to defend liberty and protect liberty by their laws. But without regeneration, girls, it would never come about. We never, ever, ever see anything but a horrific tyranny and dystopia as presented in the Hunger Games.
Because for Katniss, really all she's doing is just poking on the tip of an iceberg, where you need to start from the bottom and just start building up again.
And Katniss's real problem, her fundamental problem, is that she feared the tyranny more than she feared God. You see, this is the fundamental issue. And if you fear something besides God, you will, in the end, make the fatal mistake. And as it turns out, Michael was visiting us from Arkansas. And Michael, we've had a good time having you over, and you know you've been off on an adventure with my son Daniel. But you took the time to review the movie with us tonight, and I wanted some of your feedback. What did you think as you watched this movie?
Well, one thing that was very interesting was the way the screenwriters crafted the story. so that you sympathize with the main character, Katniss. And so because you sympathize with her, you will accept anything she really does. And I think that's why it's so good to come to these, to watch any film, not with your mind turned off, but to be discerning.
That's very good. That's very good.
To be discerning, to make sure that you're not just accepting all these pagan ideas mm-hmm. into your thoughts.
Yeah, and I think here's what's important is you got to step back and say, okay, who's the good guy, who's the bad guy, and why? 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 You got to ask that question. You know, sometimes it's easy to just to take it for granted the guy who's really, really, really ugly is the bad guy, and the really, really cool young lady is the good guy. And so that's typically, you know, the simplistic way that people take these things. They don't think deeply about it. They don't say, okay, based upon God's ethical standards, not by politically correct standards of the day, that changes with the whims of society. No. On the rock solid standard of God's laws and God's ethics, who's the good guy? Who's the bad guy? Now, it's true that the tyrants were tyrants and they were not good guys. But then again, you start looking at Katniss and you look at her perspective of God. You look at how she treats other people, how she does engage in killing on a fairly regular basis when she's given the opportunity. She does. You begin to wonder, is she really so much the heroine that she's cut out to be?
Well, she looks good next to the main villain, but she's not. She certainly didn't make very ethical decisions.
You know, as you watch these movies and you see here the cussing and you see the immodesty and you see the undressing scenes and yes. things, and you know we try to turn our heads, you know, and so forth. You think we risk defilement in the process, and how do we avoid that?
Well, one thing that was good was coming ahead of time, coming to the film aware of somewhat where certain scenes were. And just keep in mind that God is watching your every move. So just to have a fear of God mm-hmm. and just to try to keep your mind pure.
Yeah, I think the key thing is to just be filtering. And people who say, well, you know, you should never watch any movie or watch a road sign or a billboard or read a bumper sticker or anything that ever counters a biblical way of thinking, I don't think that's necessarily true. I think we can, from time to time, get out of the house and see some of these counter worldview, counter perspectives we have to God's word. But we got to be analyzing it constantly. We got to be discerning it by way of a biblical way of thinking. We have to be meditating on the law of God day and night. It's just we have to be immersed in the laws of God as we take in these inputs. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's the review of The Hunger Games Part 2. And I hope that this has been helpful to you as we wrap up this edition of the Generations broadcast. We have just come back. It's 11:30 at night. And we're wrapping up what we assessed in our review of Catching Fire, Hunger Games Part 2, a huge blockbuster, a record-breaking blockbuster for a November box office total of $161 million. If you'd like to interact with this radio program, just email me directly at host@kevinswanson.com. Get your friends and family members tuning into this program. We need people to be more discerning on a broader level. We're not just counting cuss words here. We're dealing with worldview issues. We analyze this at the very basic level. Order that we not be taken by the false philosophies of the day. Believe me, Hollywood does not share your worldview if you are a Christian. This is Kevin Swanson inviting you back again next time as we continue to lay down a vision for the next generation.